There is a scene in Tolstoy's great novel, War and Peace, where Prince Andrew and Pierre have reached a river that had overflowed its banks and which they had to cross by ferry. They stepped on the raft and continued their conversation about the aim of life, who we are as humans, about equality, and the brotherhood of humankind. In an interview with the Pocono Gazette in 2015, photographer and writer John Hodanish told Jessica Cohen that over 5 decades ago, I got so caught up in Russian culture, in Tolstoy's novel War and Peace, I wanted to read it in the original Russian. As it happens, the U.S. was at war in Vietnam, and Hodanish went on to enlist and was able to spend over a year studying the Russian language. Ultimately, he was sent to Vietnam in 1965, where he went on to explore the countryside with a camera and brought back images, including some taken while he was being ferried across a well-known river. And in addition to experiencing the horror of war, he was able to affirm something of what Tolstoy called the brotherhood of man as well. John Hodanish settled for some time here in northeastern Pennsylvania, where he exhibited the photographs he took in Vietnam, and he went on to publish a book titled Vietnam Remembered, a photographic memoir of Vietnam from 1965 through 67. Hodanish said, "I never thought to photograph the ugliness of war. Instead, I was attracted to the beauty that surrounded me in abundance on all sides, including the beauty of the human spirit." To coincide with the broadcast premiere of the PBS documentary series The Vietnam War by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick this week and next on WVIA-TV, we had a conversation with John Hodanish about his photographs and his experiences in Vietnam. We began with how he got there.
I beat the draft by enlisting, but back in February of 1963, I got a letter from my uncle directing me to report for a pre-induction physical, and I passed. So rather than just go and serve for 2 years, I decided to enlist, and then I could either select the school or select a duty assignment. So I selected the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California, because I wanted to study Russian. But I had, since it was a 12-month school, I had to enlist not for 3, but for 4 years. And I did. I did my basic training in Fort Dix, New Jersey. And then after that, I went to Monterey, California. And I studied Russian for a year there. And then at the end of the year, I was approached by the head of the Russian department there. And he said, "You've done well with the Russian. We're having an experimental program. We're going to add an additional 6 months of Russian language instruction." Monterey, California, beautiful place by the Pacific Ocean. I said, "You bet." But I had to amend my initial enlistment from 4 years to 6 years. But then I was on orders to go to Stuttgart, Germany, where I presume I would be listening to broadcasts from behind the Iron Curtain. But then in August or September 1965, there came from the Pentagon an emergency requisition asking for all warm bodies to go to Southeast Asia. So there I was. I arrived in Saigon at Tan Son Nhut Air Base on the 11th of November, 1965.
Veterans Day,
part of the initial buildup. And because I was so dedicated to preserving the world from the onslaught of communism, I was persuaded to extend my tour of duty from 1 year to a year and a half. So I actually came back home to the United States on the 28th of June, 1967, 19 months later.
And you were not out in the field with a rifle. You were doing other kinds of work because of your training.
Yes. Initially, I was given administrative duties in country at Saigon, close to the flagpole, as they say, near headquarters. Initially, I worked in the J2, the intelligence staff for General Westmoreland on Pasteur Street in Saigon. But then I wanted to get closer to the action so I would have something to tell my grandchildren. So I switched to a military intelligence battalion And they put me at the flagpole doing administrative duties, but then they said that if I wanted to get out in the field, I could extend for 6 months, and so I did. And actually was sent up country. I did a number of things. You know, we're not supposed to, in military intelligence, talk about what we did. The modus operandi is supposed to be secret. I could tell just you, maybe, but then again, we're on the air.
That did put you out into the countryside. How far north did you go?
I guess this isn't classified. I was as far north as Dak To or Quy Nhon. Quy Nhon is on the coast. Dak To is in the central highlands, but in Second Corps. And I got as far south as Con Tha, which is in the delta, right there on the Mekong River.
You weren't always in uniform.
No, I picked up the language. I did some studying at the Vietnamese American Association on Mok Dinh Chi Street in Saigon. So I picked up the language, and as my commanding officers, the officers under whom I served, so that I had a facility with the language, they gave me other assignments where I would be able to communicate with the local people. And by the way, I had a qualitatively very different experience than 99% of the GIs over there, because I could communicate with the locals.
And you also were armed not with necessarily a rifle, but you also had a camera.
That was kind of like a cover. Yeah, some of the assignments I was on, I didn't have anything to associate me as a soldier, as a military person. There were a lot of civilians in various capacities from a number of different countries in country at the time.
And was the camera yours?
It was a Minolta rangefinder camera. And it didn't survive the war. There's a lot of moisture there, and it sort of compromised the inner workings of the camera. So I switched to a different camera after a while, and it's been so long ago. You know, I returned to the United States at the end of June 1967. That's 50 years ago.
You were able, because of the nature of the work you were doing and also your interest in getting closer to the people and to the land itself, to actually take some remarkable documentary photos of life in South Vietnam.
Documentary is the operative word. Yeah, they are documentary. And I specifically and emphatically avoided taking pictures of torn bodies, torn and broken bodies, murder and mayhem. No military operations.
And that wasn't just because of the secret nature. It was not what you wanted to record.
Exactly. You got it.
You were caring about these people whose country you were in.
Well, I developed an affection for them, in part because when I communicated with them in their own language, they were surprised, and they kind of opened their homes and their hearts to me. One conversation was, which means, oh, you speak Vietnamese so well, you must have a Vietnamese girlfriend. To which I responded, no, I don't have a girlfriend. The Vietnamese girls don't seem to like me. I'm ugly. My nose is too big. They would all laugh at that. They thought that was kind of hilarious. But that's kind of how it was. And of course, the kids, when they'd see me walking down the street with a camera, they would all demand to be photographed. So I've got some photographs of kids, and they're delightful.
They weren't afraid of you, or were they?
No, good heavens. In fact, they were delighted to have an American, to have a communication with them, because most GIs couldn't communicate with them, except, of course, in English.
You have some beautiful portraits, beautiful smiling people. They're not all that way, because there's one with the very serious fellow who didn't speak to you. Tell us about that photo.
Well, I'm sorry to say, but it needs to be said, that not all Americans behave themselves in a way that would bring credit upon the United States of America. There was some racism. And I think, some of the boorish behavior I recognized on the part of fellow servicemen, I think multiplied, turned the nation against us.
And so your assignment allowed you to go to marketplaces, for example, and you have some remarkable shots of people living their daily lives. And we can see through your eyes what life might have been like at that time. in Saigon and around.
I remember one incident. I was in the Central Highlands, not far from Kontum. I was out in the jungle by myself, no arms. Actually, I did have a Bowie knife in a sheath. I had resolved not to be captured because of the way the Viet Cong were dispatching Americans whom they captured. Pretty graphic, pretty ugly. Let's just let that go. But I was walking, just sort of exploring. I was reconnoitering for some future operation, let's call it that. And I broke into a clearing on the edge of a stream. And there in the clearing opposite me was a man wearing a conical straw hat and black pajamas. And he had a primitive rake and he was working the soil. And I stood there for a moment and I was thinking, my God, I could be witnessing the scene 200 years ago. And I sort of savored the moment. And then I sort of cleared my throat. The man turned around. He looked startled initially, but I greeted him in Vietnamese. His apprehensions vanished at the point. And he invited me to come to his home, which was essentially on stilts, you know, on poles. Lifted up maybe about 4 or 5 feet above the ground as a precaution against certain vermin, snakes, and things of that nature. And we sat on a wood floor on little woven mats, and there was a large metal tray around, and his wife was there, and he had a couple sons there, grown sons there. So we sat and spoke for about an hour and a half, just making small talk about families and things of that nature. And, you know, this is the kind of experience that very, very few GIs had over there, I think.
But what it seems and what your photographs seem to indicate is that when we see those smiles in your portraits or the children waving or mugging for the camera, that there is more that unites us as humans than divides us.
Oh, my goodness. Cultural differences are just so small. The common denominator of our shared humanity links us all. We're all the same. And the smiles, they're probably reacting to some wisecrack I made in Vietnamese, you know, making small talk.
And yet we see those sobering images. Now, you were clear about not wanting to take pictures of mayhem, but you do have some photographs of captured weapons, for example. Tell us about the provenance of some of those guns.
The weapons that I photographed were on display in Saigon. I think it was December 1965. Those were among the first photographs I'd taken over there. And what had happened was that these weapons were all in a cachet. They were hidden because the cadres from the north coming down along the Ho Chi Minh Trail would carry supplies of some kind, and they would place them strategically. If they had an objective over here that they were going to attack, they wouldn't move large units openly. They would keep units small, and they would put caches of weapons and supplies, medical supplies, food and so forth, in proximity to their objective so that they could bring those things out and use them when an operation was in place. We had found one of these caches, and there are pictures in this book that show the weapons. Now, these are Warsaw Pact weapons. East German, Czech, Soviet, and Chinese Communist. That's about it, yeah.
You were out there doing some hitchhiking along the Mekong River.
Yeah, it was kind of like reconnoitering. I wanted to see what the countryside was like. I felt it was appropriate for me to, in an unobtrusive way, to just get the lay of the land and see what was what. And I taken some sort of a public conveyance downstream from Kanta, a few miles. And I was walking back to Kanta along the right bank of the Mekong River. And I heard a motor on the river. And I turned and saw this open boat with three people in it. And I called out in Vietnamese, "Hey, give me a lift to Kan Tha." So the fellow at the helm brought the boat ashore. I got aboard. It was an open boat about, 20, 22 feet long, made of local mahogany, which grows there. And they use it quite a bit. Very useful, very hard, very durable wood. So I took several pictures from the boat of settlements along the shore until we got all the way to Kantan.
It has been suggested that you take your photographs back to Vietnam. Is that something that you'd like to do?
Well, I was in Slovakia a few years ago, and I met some North Vietnamese there. And a friend of mine who's Slovak got in touch with a friend of his who's Hungarian but lives in Slovakia. And they had an exhibition of my photography there. And the Vietnamese ambassador, Nguyen Xuân Lu, who spoke English, he was very cordial. And he showed up at the exhibition and made a presentation, gave me a bouquet of flowers. And it was sort of a media event in Slovakia that an American GI and the Vietnamese ambassador should shake hands in front of the camera. You know, not like Americans, by law, are forbidden to conduct foreign policy unless they have some sort of credential to do that. But it was, I wasn't conducting foreign policy. In any case, he said, take your pictures to Vietnam, and what you should do is go to Washington and approach the Vietnamese ambassador to Washington and let him help you. He'll help you arrange things. Well, I couldn't get past the press and cultural attaché.
What's the reaction from others who have served when they see your images?
Mixed. For some American veterans, it brings up memories that they just as soon not have. And others are saying, oh, yeah, my God, I remember that. I was there. You know, they basically are very enthusiastic about it. But, you know, the unfortunate thing is wars are ugly, okay? That's a given. When a war is going on, young men go off to fight, and some of them die. And the ones that don't die come back to the United States and eventually become old men with memories we just as soon not have. Because I'm not proud of everything I did over there. And the things that you do in the course of a war, why, it wouldn't even cross your mind to do them if you just stayed home. But you get caught up. First of all, you're trained to use weaponry, which is lethal. And you do things that you later on regret. And there's a lot of that. And a lot of American veterans, they kind of medicate with drugs and alcohol. And it's kind of a lost generation.
Why did you put together the book?
I guess basically the book has a lot of nice pictures. And that was part of it. I wanted to basically commit to paper, commit to publish something about a way of life. But I also wanted to make an anti-war statement. And the book in the epilogue has that very strongly, and also in the foreword as well.
Just the images alone, again, we go back to that sense of our common humanity, and that comes across so strongly in these images.
Oh, my goodness. You know, people really need to go out, reach out to people who are different than themselves. In this country, when they're abroad, recognize a phenomenon called ethnocentrism, because if you don't recognize that, you could become the proverbial ugly American. You know, people need to be sensitive to other cultures, other ways of doing things. You know, we are internationalists in the kitchen. We eat spring rolls and tacos and all kinds of stuff. Sushi. Well, I know some people don't care for sushi.
Ken Burns, we know when he created the Civil War series, people were saying we still haven't come to terms with the Civil War. There are still issues alive. And that was a great conversational vehicle for Americans to continue the conversation about the Civil War and not bury that. Now we have a chance to take in his Vietnam series. Why do you think that might be important for us?
Well, mostly if it serves to raise consciousness and to broaden everyone's frame of reference, give them more information, you can't really make decisions in the absence of good, accurate information.
Photographer and writer John Hudanish, speaking with us about his experiences in Vietnam and his book, Vietnam Remembered, a photographic memoir of a Vietnam veteran from 1965 through 1967, with text written in English, Vietnamese, and Russian. For more information on the web, vietnamremembered.us, vietnamremembered.us. It's John Hudanish, Vietnam Remembered, a photographic memoir of a Vietnam veteran, And Houdanish is spelled H-U-D-A-N-I-S-H. John Houdanish, Vietnam Remembered. And for more information on the web, vietnamremembered.us. We had this conversation with John Houdanish to coincide with the premiere of the new PBS documentary, The Vietnam War, by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, that began Sunday night on WVIA-TV. It is a 10-part, 18-hour series that will run each night this week through Thursday, and again this coming Sunday through Thursday at 8 o'clock, and that's 8 o'clock each night. For more information on the WVIA website, wvia.org, wvia.org, the premiere of the PBS documentary, The Vietnam War, by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, and it's tonight and tomorrow night at 8, and again this coming Sunday through Thursday at 8 o'clock each evening. For more information on the WVIA website, wvia.org.